Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting The Kingdom Choir, Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour, and I'm here with Mr. Dennis Hart. Susan Franson is tied and gagged in the back room, and we are taking over. Just kidding. Actually, Susan is in Sweden right now, enjoying herself with Fritz. And I think she's in Stockholm, and Dennis and I are going to try and handle Local Talk Wednesday.
Well, I don't know. I think we can do this, Ursula, but these are big shoes to fill, aren't they? So, Susan, have a great time in Sweden if you're listening to us on the World Wide Web. And for all of the rest of us, stick around. We are going to have an interesting show because Michael Crum, the editor of the Ames Tribune, makes a return engagement here. And do we have a few things to talk about that are going around this community right now,
Ursula? Lots going on in Ames. And we actually will hear a little bit from Susan, too. Through the magic of technology, she did send us a recorded clip from Stockholm, which is actually quite interesting. She spoke with friends of the family of Greta Thunberg, the teenager who led last week's global climate strike. Small world, huh? Sweden and you meet her family.
Good heavens.
Before we get started, Dennis, with this very interesting week and Mr. Crum, please give us some headline news to get us started.
Several major stories, Ursula, have bubbled up here in Ames. In fact, we might say erupted in the past few days. One of them involves what allegedly happened at the football game a couple of weekends ago between Iowa State University and the University of Iowa. This past Monday, Iowa President Bruce Herold questioned whether the annual game between his university and Iowa State should continue. This after band members at the U of I claimed that one of their members suffered broken ribs and another was assaulted as they left Jack Trice Stadium after the game. Herold said he was not convinced the game should continue in either Iowa City or Ames unless, in his words, we can protect our fans, our band, and, of course, our athletes. Then yesterday, Iowa State Athletic Director Jamie Pollard fired back, accusing Iowa's band members of leaving through the wrong gate outside the stadium. He said that led to a log jam with existing fans that might have resulted in physical contact. Pollard also said that any heckling or pelting of Iowa's band members by fans was, in Pollard's words, embarrassing and inexcusable. But he also said Iowa State's band members have been subjected to similar abuse while performing in Iowa City. Iowa State President Wendy Winterstein said the school wants to find ways to make football games safer for fans. All of this coming after Pollard held a news conference last week outlining plans for a possible retail and entertainment complex that he'd like to see built in the parking lot between Jack Trice Stadium and the Hilton Coliseum. Pollard said a $300,000 feasibility study would soon get underway to determine how it might get built. He said it's way too soon to speculate about how much that might cost. Also yesterday, word that the Federal Highway Administration had told the city of Ames that the colorful crosswalks at 5th Street and Douglas, crosswalks celebrating the city's diversity, did not comply with standards used by road managers to design traffic control devices across the nation. The Fed said the display of color creates dangerous conditions for pedestrians. City Attorney Mark Lambert said he did not believe the Highway Administration has any jurisdiction over the matter because Douglas and 5th are not federal roads, highways, or interstates. But a federal spokeswoman said the government does have jurisdiction. Ames City Council members talked about this last night, all 10 minutes worth of discussion, and decided not to respond to the letters sent by the Federal Highway Administration. Also this week, police still looking for the man who attacked a female jogger in Ames on Sunday night. It took place on Carroll Avenue near Banshell Park. The victim was stabbed 3 times and suffered non-life-threatening injuries. Police said the attack apparently random, with no apparent motive. Hunt on, as I said, for the suspect. And one more note. This is about the man who helped raise more than $1 million for Children's Hospital in Iowa City. Carson King was his name. He had held up a sign during ESPN's Game Day broadcast here in Ames 2 weekends ago, asking for money to buy beer. That generated an amazing response, and the beer company pledged to match the donations King received. $1 million. All well and good until last night, when the beer company severed its ties with Carson King because of racist tweets he had posted on Twitter when he was a high school student 7 years ago, 16 years old. But the company said, yes, it will honor the donation pledge. And there you have it, Ursula, quite a week of bubbling and bursting of stories here in Ames.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. That's
that's amazing.
Bubbling up, bubbling over.
Yes.
Lots going on in Ames.
Indeed. Well, we have a guest here to talk about all of this today. We are very pleased
to have... Could not have a more perfect person here today.
Thank you. Hey, we're all perfect today, aren't we? Michael Crum, editor of the Ames Tribune. You're perfect today, aren't you?
We're all as perfect as anybody else. and I think that kind of maybe is a segue into the Carson King story.
Wow, what a story.
You know, it's... First, let me say this. From someone who's been doing what I've been doing for a long, long time, and I think it doesn't matter if you're in broadcast or print... or in today's world of social media, everything you do, one is a judgment call. Mm-hmm. You can do it today in an hour or tomorrow or whatever. You might go, yeah, I should have done something a little bit differently. You may also just, absolutely regret it. But it's also everything is scrutinized so much more today than it ever was before. I'm not going to question the Des Moines Register for doing the background check to find this tweet. I think that was something that they did. They felt they needed to for whatever reason. Obviously, I'm not privy to that to their processes. But it is a tough thing to do to every day, make those judgment calls. And is this the right thing to be doing today?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's part of a bigger story, though, Michael, where. This is a moment of history in this nation where there is a reckoning going
Absolutely.
On with who we are and what we have said as a nation in the past.
Is it fair, so, though? I mean, and I'm throwing this out there because I have my own personal thoughts. But is it fair to be if I say something when I'm 25 or 30, is it fair to hold me accountable when I'm 54, going to be 55, compared to when I'm 14, 15, 16 years old? And I think that's one of the big things. Is there a difference from doing something as a reckless teenager to doing something when – and there's degrees. I don't want to downplay anything. But there's degrees to those mistakes, obviously. But – should someone be held accountable at the same level when they're 25 or 30 as they are when they're 14, 15, or 16, at some point in the future? I think that's up for debate.
That's a very tough question. Now,
and it is a tough question.
Today, the Register is being ripped apart by folks who say, why did you do this? Why did you report this? They would have been ripped apart had this come out. And they, having known it, not reported it. I mean,
Correct.
It is a fact that this young man at the age of 16 wrote some racist tweets. And we're not going to mention what they are here. You can find them on the internet.
I think to maybe my understanding is he was quoting things that he heard from a TV show, from a Tosh 2.0 or whatever the name of the show is. It's a Comedy Central show.
Yeah.
It is kind of a raucous, raunchy program with that level of humor. And so... Is I'm not defending the tweets. I'm just simply putting this out there. Is that necessarily what he believed at the time? I don't know.
But this is a cautionary tale, and we've seen this
absolutely
with many other people now. They don't seem to understand because they're young, perhaps, or perhaps they don't even think about it. Everything you put on social media is there forever. It follows you whether you like it or not. So something 30 years from now, in this case, seven years later, it can come back and really bite you, and it's happening.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that goes back to your point that we're kind of at a point of reckoning, that we are holding people accountable for things that they did at some point in the past. And for someone who's on social media, and I follow social media, the number of people that I saw that were tweeting out in response to this, thank goodness there wasn't social media when I was 16 years old.
Mm. Right, and... The other side of it is that people who have not had to feel accountable, particularly white men, quite frankly, who have never had to historically feel accountable, are now being asked to do so. And $1 million is a weighty sum. I mean, this wasn't just about a teenager's tweets. This is about a significant amount of money and a significant amount of support from a business. And so they're responding to that.
Mm-hmm.
They're responding to their gesture. Now, I didn't quite understand what you said, Dennis. You saying they're going ahead and giving the donation.
They are going to match the donations, right? They're doing that, but they're severing their ties with him in terms of, we don't want to be associated with you anymore. In fact, you can't find him on their website anymore. I tried this morning. It's gone. But the company like that, and we've seen this again recently and in the more distant past, companies are so sensitive right now, as they must be, to anything like this. They can't stand any hint of scandal. And this is a hint of wrongdoing, right? Right.
And so how they're severing themselves from Carson is they were going to hold like a big tailgate party where he was going to be at. They've canceled that. They were producing cans with his face on them. And those cans were going to be only given to – we're only going to be on the cans of the year supply of Busch Light that they were going to give him. They weren't going to be out there for commercial sale.
Right.
They're stopping that process. But they are going to honor their donation, which is, you know, I think the right thing for them to do at this point. But there are, you know, but so that's how those are the ways that they're stepping away from it. And you're right. They've taken all their links to his social media and everything off of their website and any reference to him off their website. And it is kind of a firestorm this morning because people really started to learn about this yesterday evening. And I think for every – and there's people on both sides of it who feel very, very, very adamant in their position.
This is really a sign, I think, of our cultural divide right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. I mean, there is no forgiveness on anybody's part. And we're certainly seeing that at the highest levels of our government right now with what's happening. But he's being excoriated by some. The Des Moines Register is being excoriated. And we get back to this situation of the news media can do nothing right now. And you're the perfect person to talk about that. The Register, and this is a tough call, as you've just said, they had the information. Had they not put it up there, they'd have been accused of covering up for this gentleman. They put it up there and they're accused of, you're just killing this guy. You're bad news. You news media, you always do this. How do you respond to something like that? You're always just tearing things down.
Well, I mean, it's, as I said earlier, it's a judgment call.
It is.
You know, every decision we make, whether it's how we cover city council, how we cover, you know, doing a profile piece on someone, to how we write a story about a crime that's happened in town.
Yeah.
There's a thought process and a discussion that goes into all of that. And from the media's perspective, we try to make the right decisions that we think are, you know, that present the information in a way that is in the best interest of the public and our readers while still being fair to the people that we're reporting on. However, absolutely right, you know, and to a great extent, I think local media is somewhat fortunately kind of buffered a little bit from some of this only because we don't do some of the reporting at the level of the reporting that maybe like the national media, which takes, you know, really a lot of criticism and sometimes rightfully so. The story on Carson King, I mean, it's a tough call. You're right. You're damned if you print it. You're damned if you don't. And so where do you find that balance and how do you make that decision? And honestly, probably it's in the best interest of media, no matter if it's local or national, and it's in the best interest of the readers to have the information.
Would you have put it in if it had been your call?
Probably, yeah. I mean, fortunately, I wasn't in the position. I know a conversation we're going to have today is we're going to be, should we do a story about the story?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
And so then what we do is, at this point, what value is that to our readers who already know it? Who have already read it everywhere, who've already seen it everywhere, do we owe it? Is there not? Do we have an obligation to Ames Tribune readers to report on the story? And I think that the answer is probably going to be yes. We'll have that conversation later in the newsroom.
I saw another story in that too, other than just how accountable people have to be these days. When I heard that the beer company had gone so far as to create a beer can with his face on it and to hold a tailgate party, it sounded to me they saw an opportunity to do a publicity campaign. they got pulled up short on that. Because when I heard that, I thought that is a very thin excuse for an advertising campaign. You know, a man just saying he wanted beer. And I felt that was on pretty thin ice already to do that. When this happened, it kind of caused them to pull back and say, what are we basing a promotional campaign on? What are we using for marketing here? And are we being a little bit reckless? And that's what it felt more to me like, because I'm not sure what Carson did in the first place to warrant that kind of heroic acknowledgement.
If you wanted to be in our newsroom, you know, when this started, you probably would have heard me say somewhat similar things. Mm-hmm. What started out really as, I think, a joke and a prank by him just to go, hey, I'm a college kid, I need more beer.
Turned into a marketing campaign.
A lot of good has come from that because so many people have jumped on the bandwagon. And then both Anheuser-Busch and Venmo have agreed to match.
Right.
Prairie Meadows, where this kid works, I think said that they're going to donate $10,000. So, I mean, a lot of good things have happened because of it.
I think they acknowledged that because they continued with the donation.
Yes.
They just pulled back the marketing campaign.
But they pulled back the marketing campaign. So I think absolutely Anheuser-Busch looked at this and went,
what are we doing?
Well, I mean, at the beginning, they're thinking, holy smokes, what a cool way to continue to promote and get our name out there. People make fun, I guess, of the fact that Busch Light supposedly is like people's favorite beer in Iowa.
You know, I think
I think they really jumped all over that. And now you're right. I think they see this thing, a couple of tweets where people are now going, oh, wait, should we even be attached to this kid?
And how they couldn't continue supporting him after those tweets came out, after word of them came out. But this also shows some of the priorities of our country. The kid held up a sign.
Right.
He didn't generate $1 million. People sent money into him on a sign that said, I need money for beer. And it shows the priorities, I guess, of our country in some ways. You've got a lot of nonprofits out there that need a lot of money or some money to survive. And this kid gets $1 million for holding up a sign saying, I need beer. I don't know what that says about our culture.
By the way, KHOI needs beer.
Where's
really,
the sign?
Really
I see that sign
beer.
You've just made. It's wonderful. Okay. Let's talk about another story that's just roiling two communities today. It's about the Iowa-Iowa State football game and the response to it and what's happened since then. Just to backtrack people, Iowa band members said they were verbally and physically assaulted as they left the stadium after the game a couple of weekends ago here at Jack Trice Stadium. One band member allegedly suffered broken ribs. Both ISU and Iowa were said to have conducted brief investigations and then apparently closed them. Iowa band members then, this past weekend, alleged a cover-up on the part of the universities. So on Monday, Iowa President Bruce Harreld said discussions should be held about how to ensure student safety, and that if it can't be ensured, maybe the Iowa-ISU football game should end. And yesterday, ISU Athletic Director Jamie Pollard said that similar things, something probably happened to the Iowa band, because similar things, he said, have happened to the Iowa State band in Iowa City. Michael, your sports editor, Travis Hines, writes today in the Tribune, in I think an excellent column, that it's a failure of leadership that we're seeing right now on the part of both universities. How do you feel about that?
I agree. I mean, we had a situation where I think ISU reached out to the University of Iowa, tried to have a conversation initially, was told that there were problems, and then I think at some point, my understanding is the University of Iowa kind of backed off a little bit. And then the University of Iowa president came out the other day, I believe in an interview with the Daily Iowa, the university's student newspaper over there, throwing the gauntlet saying, I don't believe that we should move forward with this game if we can't ensure safety of, you know, the band and fans and the teams. People shouldn't mistake that this is really all about money. At the end of the day, this is a big money venture. It's got sponsors behind the Cy-Hawk series. It's a popular game. It draws a lot of people to both communities when the games are played there. And so I think what happened is Bruce Harreld's comments the other day caught Iowa State people off guard. So they felt that they needed to respond yesterday.
How did you feel about the response? Responding to Bruce Harreld, who's the president of the university, it was Jamie Pollard,
mm-hmm.
who assertively says, this happened to us over there. And they left by the wrong gate. The Iowa band may have left. That seems to a disinterested observer to be perhaps an inappropriate response to what the president of the university was saying over in Iowa City, that we ought to discuss this and talk about the future. What's your response to the university, Iowa State's response to this
thing? Well, I think I don't believe that it's a surprise that what happened to the Iowa band probably to certain degrees has happened to the Iowa State band. I think that's common knowledge. Those things happen at football games. The response, I believe that Jamie Pollard probably deflected a little bit of the blame. The whole idea about the band going out the wrong exit, if they were told that, hey, you should go here, but they went here, I mean, it's hard to know. You know, the video that they've released for both that and the on-field verbal altercation between, I think it was the band director and the director of facilities, you don't hear what was said. You can't see it. So it's really hard to judge anything based on the videos. Right. But the response, I mean, it is what it is. I think it's Iowa State trying to protect themselves. I think it's Iowa State saying, hey, it's not all our fault. And I think that's probably wasn't the best response by Jamie. But he was trying to make a point, I think, to really try to expand the level of the concern and expand the level of, if you want to use the word blame, to make sure that it wasn't, you know, it's just not Iowa State fans misbehaving. There were other problems that he wanted to try to identify.
Randy Peterson in today's Register echoes what Travis says in your paper, that the current level of discussion on this is not helpful to anybody. It doesn't move anything forward. The blame game, in other words,
no,
isn't going to propel us toward good feelings. And right now, it seems as if, and we know on social media, Iowa State fans are blowtorching Iowa fans. Iowa fans are blowtorching Iowa State. None of this is healthy right now, what's going on.
Well, I think if both sides would come out and say, you want to know what, we're going to meet, we're going to talk, we're going to work to resolve these issues, and these are the issues, you know, and keep some sort of transparency so that they're identifying what the issues are as they're identified. The issues that were identified yesterday are really, except for maybe the one where the Iowa band member, you know, suffered broken ribs because he was pushed over while carrying a ladder, are really a far cry from what some of the original allegations were of, like, sexual assault. Mm-hmm. I understand that it's hard for law enforcement at either university or in either community to investigate if someone doesn't come forward with an actual complaint. It is difficult for them to do that. But I think if leaders from both institutions would just come together, say, you want to know, we're going to hold this discussion. We believe this is a thing that needs to move forward, that this game is of value to both communities, both from a fan and a sports aspect, but also from an economic standpoint, and that we'll keep you apprised as we make progress through this discussion, and if you want to use the word investigation, and to try to reach some mutually agreeable resolution to this, I think that would have been a better way to do it than this blame game and this firing off on these independent little news conferences going back and forth.
It cannot be that hard to keep fans and band members safe at a football game. And Peterson had a suggestion earlier in the week in a column in the Register that when the game's being played here in Ames, that the Iowa State band put themselves into a line before setting up a line so that the Iowa band can go between the Iowa State band members into the stadium and out of the stadium. And the same thing happened over in Iowa City where the Iowa City band, that seems like a reasonable suggestion to me. In other words, band members protecting band members. That seems like it's a cooperative effort. Now, I don't know whether that's going to take place, but it's not a bad place to start.
I think it's a great idea. Whether schools can come together and reach that sort of level of cooperation and respect, I don't know.
One of the things that I always notice when these Iowa games happen here in Ames is that, you know, you see everybody walking towards the stadium. And I'm always struck that I see groups of people mixed. Some people are wearing Cyclone T-shirts and some are wearing the Hawkeye T-shirts. And it's always struck me that the fans have always been very collegial with each other, and I would hate to see that come to an end. Yeah. We're speaking with Michael Crum, the editor of the Ames Tribune, talking about some of the stuff that has happened in Ames.
Where
our apologies to the people that are accustomed to hearing about outside of Ames on Wednesday. This is kind of a special day. Susan is in Sweden, but we will hear a little bit from her from Sweden. Dennis, can we take a short music break?
And then
we'll come back and talk some more with Mr. Crum.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Crum.
Welcome back to Local Talk. This is Wednesday. I'm Dennis Hart, and my co-host is Ursula Rudenberg. Our guest today, Michael Crum, the editor of the Ames Tribune. We're talking about a lot of things that have gone on here in Ames in the last couple of days. This is kind of a special broadcast. So far, we've talked about Carson King, the Bud Light guy, the Bush guy, who has now been severed from his relationship with the beer company because of some tweets. Talked about the Iowa State, Iowa band controversy. And now, Michael, this latest one, banner headline in your paper yesterday, the Federal Highway Administration asking, not ordering, the city of Ames to get rid of those crosswalks at the corner of 5th and Douglas painted to celebrate diversity in the city. The feds say this is a potential danger because it doesn't correspond with their guidelines for how to build crosswalks. Last night, the city council discusses it for all of 9 or 10 minutes, says, we're not going to do anything about that. We're not even going to respond. What's your take on this? I mean,
I don't think the city council should have taken any action at all. So I think they acted appropriately last night. I think the Federal Highway Administration, I'm curious to know more about their reasoning, because if you look at what the guidelines are, there are certain things where they talk about that you need to have, you know, solid white lines to help show where people are supposed to stop and to kind of outline the crosswalk.
And they have that.
They have those here.
Yeah, the white lines are there.
The white lines are there. So I'm not sure what the issue is. I think they've been, for the most part, I've heard little to no criticism of the crosswalks. I think they represent something good and positive about the community of Ames. And there's no federal money that's spent to maintain that intersection. There's no federal money spent to paint those designs and those colors there. So for the Federal Highway Administration to intervene and say, hey, this doesn't meet federal guidelines, I'm kind of curious about that.
It is very curious. Dennis, what was the city council's justification for not pursuing this?
Mark Lambert had told them, city attorney, that he does not believe, in his legal opinion, that the feds have jurisdiction over this issue. There was no serious discussion at the council. They thought, I don't know what they thought. It's hard to get into their heads, but they were not going to respond to this. They simply said it's not worthy of this city's response. And you have to wonder, and I wonder, why the federal government, we have a few major issues going on in the United States right now, exemplified by what happened yesterday. We know where we're headed down that road. But here's the question. Why in the world would the federal government come into Ames, Iowa, to discuss this issue, which on the surface, there are no national implications here? This is a pretty small issue.
Well, as Michael says, it's curious. Now, as somebody who manages an organization which is actually answerable to the federal government, the KHOI has to answer to the FCC, I know from experience that pretty much the way these things happen is somebody calls up the FCC, or in this case, the Highway, Federal Highway Commission, and complains, somebody local. The FCC is never going to come to KHOI and, you know, sue us for misbehavior until somebody calls them and says, this radio station in my community is doing something I don't like. So pretty sure that this happened because somebody locally complained. And that's what I think is really interesting. I remember when the crosswalks were in the ribbon cutting ceremony, I was interviewing the folks out there and I asked them, you know, do you expect pushback? And the answer was, there's always pushback. So I want to know who called up the federal government. That's what I want to know.
The answer may be on the Ames Tribune's Facebook page, because I think when we did the original story, there was one individual. And I saw the comment where the individual stated that these weren't in compliance with federal guidelines.
Oh, there it is.
There it is.
Did they give their name?
I believe they gave their name, but on Facebook you can create usernames that aren't yours.
Yeah. Well, we'll bring them on to Local Talk and ask them.
Well, we'll see if that's that person. But that was the only hint. There was no – I've heard no other criticisms.
Yeah.
I've heard no other complaints about it. So, again – with all the other things the federal government has to worry about and should be worrying about, why crosswalks in Ames, Iowa are even on.
By the way, it was Mark Lambert. I said Michael because I was looking at you, Michael Crum. Mark Lambert, the city attorney who said that last night, doesn't believe they have jurisdiction. And yet there – it's not – I hate to say – use this – it's not completely black and white for this colorful crosswalk because, as you know, Iowa Code does say – that it will defer to the federal government on their requirements. And yet, the feds put no money into this particular crosswalk. And there are exceptions that in Des Moines has certainly a colorful crosswalk. So, I mean, it's not completely black and white. I think the issue is, why is this an issue at this point?
Because somebody in Ames thought it was. Because these crosswalks exist in other communities, too.
They do.
Well, you look here in Ames where a couple of years ago they put down the green paint for bike lanes and the bike zones at intersections.
The feds approved that.
I would imagine. But that's a little more confusing than probably the crosswalks.
That's also common out in California.
Right.
I can't speak for other states, the green bicycle lanes. So very, very interesting thing here. Again, you wonder why this is an issue. And again, being a safety concern, that's almost laughable because, as you know, it's a four-way stop at 5th and Douglas. Everybody's stopping. It's very difficult to run into somebody, I would think.
Especially because there's hardly any cars out there.
Well, and again, not only is it a four-way stop, but it's a low speed, 225. Yeah. You have a stop sign. No one's really even getting up to speed at that point, probably to 25 miles an hour. So it's a low speed area.
I mean, Ames did this because they wanted to symbolically take a stand on diversity and inclusion.
Right.
So now the whole country knows that Ames, Iowa stands for diversity and inclusion because I've been getting emails from all over the country saying, what's going on in Ames with your crosswalks? So Ames has made a statement now.
Let's talk about another issue. And this one is just a little concerning. Well, it's more than a little concerning. Without blowing it up into something bigger, an incident Sunday night on Carroll Street near Banshell Park in Ames where a female jogger, it was 7:40 at night, it was dark, because it's getting dark earlier, is attacked by an unknown man, stabbed three times, non-life-threatening injuries. That is, there are no unsafe areas in general terms in this community. That was a shocker to that neighborhood. And as your paper has pointed out in the Des Moines Register, it's one of a series of things that have happened in the last couple of years. We know that Celia Barquina Rosamena, the Iowa State University student, was stabbed and killed a year ago. We know that other women have been attacked near Iowa State University in the last 2 or 3 years. What's your sense, Michael? And all of these random. Police are not saying this is there's no connection here. What's your sense about the concern in the community? Are you sensing anything in the way of worries about what may be happening?
So last Sunday, we did a story kind of marking the one-year anniversary of Celia's murder.
Yes.
We talked to some students. We talked to students a few weeks after she was killed. I think the general sense is that Ames is still a safe place. I think that's what makes these things so shocking to people.
Yes.
Is people still have that sense, and I think rightfully so, that Ames is a safe place. We are generally a low-crime community. particularly very low on the violent crime scale. So should people be concerned? People should, yeah, absolutely be concerned. Should they go into panic mode? And, I mean, that's not what police want.
Right.
I don't think that's in the best interest of the community. It is random. You know, knock on wood, there isn't another attack. The problem is whoever did this is still out there.
That's right.
We don't know the circumstances. We don't know, you know, as far as what the attacker was doing prior to the attack, but it doesn't matter. It happened, and I think people still believe that Ames is a safe place, and I believe that that's why they think that that's why they see these things as being so shocking, you know, why it does instill that greater sense of fear. But I'm not seeing a great sense of you know, people worrying about living in Ames, and Ames is still a place where people leave their cars running when they run in a store downtown. And I've talked to people that in Ames, they still leave their doors unlocked at night. So it is random. I think it still would be considered a very isolated occurrence here in Ames. But I think it's something that in today's world, the world is changing. We've talked about that a lot this morning. People do need to always maintain that heightened sense of vigilance, I suppose.
Your story on Sunday reported just that. You quoted several female students and walkers and residents who now still walk and they'll still jog, but they're looking. They're vigilant, more so than they were before last September.
Correct.
On this. And I do the same thing. This is the safest community we've ever lived in, and my wife and I have lived all across the country, and we live part of the year in California. This is completely safe. And I have no fear. I'm a man. But I'm noticing more than I did. I am now being more vigilant than I was. Who's down the street? Who's two blocks away? And that's just, I think, real life right now all across the country. You do that.
Yeah, and if I may respectfully say, this is a conversation going on between two men.
100%.
And that's why you should jump in.
The world has never been a safe place for women. This whole discussion about being a safe place or not, it's a little bit of a fantasy, but no woman can maintain that fantasy. The world is not safe.
Yeah.
Ames, Iowa has never been safe for women. We have Access, which is a very active organization for good reason, because there's violence against women happening here and everywhere else across the world.
And we don't have a true understanding of that, but yeah. I absolutely do understand what you're saying, and you're absolutely right. This is a conversation going on between two older white guys.
And I think
and we do have a different level of understanding than other people.
And I think the reason we're having the conversation is not because we don't recognize that violence against women is taking place everywhere. It's that in this particular incident and in the others, it took place on a public street.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of things happen, unfortunately, and I've covered it all my life inside closed doors. There's no question about that. But this was kind of shocking because how often does a woman on the street of Ames get attacked? Not often. Thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Right. And that's true. But I think the way that the person being attacked on the street is part of a continuum.
Right.
Yes. And it's not an isolated incident where in a safe community where something happens.
Yeah.
It's part of a spectrum of activities. And this is kind of the extreme end of the spectrum. But they're all connected by this culture of violence against women.
Yep.
I can relate to what you're saying, Michael, about Ames feeling like a safe place. I know that sense of comfort that comes from being in Ames, and I enjoy that. But to be honest, I lived in New York for 40 years. I don't think that I behave a whole lot differently here in Ames as I do there. Because that spectrum is really part of our society, the potential is always there. There's a lot of things happening all the time that don't fall within that comfort zone. Excuse me. Getting all choked up.
It's a good conversation, a great conversation to have.
Excuse me.
Let's talk about, we have just enough time to talk about something else. And this involves you and the papers you oversee, a couple of the papers you oversee, mm-hmm. the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times. Marlis Barker who's been editing those papers, recently left. And we have an interview that Susan Franzen did with Marlis talking about what she's going to remember most about what she did here. And then we're going to talk to you about replacing her
Absolutely.
And the future of the newspapers.
Yeah, I think that Susan relied pretty heavily on Marlis for,
she did.
For getting stories for Local Talk.
So let's hear this interview with Marlis Barker.
Connecting people to people is really what I've done in my journalism career. It's just who I am to be a small-town newspaper person. When I first came to the Nevada Journal, it was February of 1991, and I worked for 3 full years into February of 1994, and then I left the newspapers at that time and did some things and worked for the sheriff's office and 911 dispatch center, and then my good friend Annette Forbes asked me if there was any chance I would consider coming back, and I missed it because I love the writing and I love the type of writing that small town papers are. So I decided to go back. So it isn't without a lot of heartache that I've decided to leave it at this time. But the industry has changed so much. It was getting to the point where it was kind of down to me for those two papers. My longtime assistant had retired this month. And I just didn't know if I could keep up with all of the new digital things. And so there are some great young reporters at the Tribune. And I know Kylie Mullen is a wonderful reporter. She's new. And she actually just bought a home in Nevada with her husband. And I'm sure she'll keep an eye on Nevada as much as possible and do some great stories. She's a wonderful writer. A lot of the freelance writers that I've had over the years, some of them are going to continue writing and covering stories.
I'm glad to know that even without you, that the papers will continue.
Yeah.
Well, I heard that you have a Facebook page that you enjoy and are going to continue. Is that right?
I do. About a year and a half ago, I think, I started to do a page called Stories by Marlis Barker, and it's about people, places, and passions. That's what the stories I like to do are about. They tie people, places, and passions together because really it's about those things that we all connect. So I think when I see the kind of story I really want to do, I can put things there that can be shared. And I can also, you know, maybe in time do some contributing to the paper again.
What's the name of your Facebook page?
Stories. Just the word Stories by Marlis Barker.
Well, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Best wishes.
Thanks, Susan.
Marlis.
Thank you. It's always been a pleasure to come visit with you or to visit with you when you call. So
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Susan Franzen talking with Marlis Barker, the former editor of the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times. Michael, talk about what you've done to replace her.
Well, we have a new reporter. We were very fortunate that we found someone in short order. Her name is Katie Mauck. She is going to be starting 2 weeks from today, I believe, either 2 weeks from today or tomorrow. I'll have to look at the actual date. We're never going to replace a Marlis, right? I mean, you take someone who's been there, who's lived there, who's been so much a part of that community. You lose that. You lose the institutional knowledge. What we gain, though, however, is the ability to look at how we can do things differently. Everything we do today in all aspects of our lives, we buy cars differently, we buy clothes differently, we buy our groceries differently. We do everything different than we did 10, 15, 25, 30 years ago. How we consume our news is completely different than how people consume their news, you know, in when we were children and in our parents' generation. Our focus is much more on digital now. What we're looking at doing, and I think in the long run, this will benefit all of our weekly newspapers, the Story City Herald, the Nevada Journal, and the Tri-County Times, and even some of the other newspapers that we own in the area, is we are looking to build one larger centralized reporting staff so that we don't have these people isolated as single reporter operations trying to put out a whole paper by themselves. What we're looking at now is having a team of 6 or 7 reporters that really we can spread out across the county to make sure that we best serve all these communities to the best of our ability, trying to drive readers digitally so that we are able to have that daily presence online that we desperately need at the weeklies, while still making sure that we are putting the news in the print versions of the papers that we know our readers want.
Let's talk briefly. We've got about a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a future for print? A lot of folks are worried about the newspapers as the things on print, the Ames Tribune, the Nevada Journal. What's the future?
It's throwing a dart at a board because things continue to evolve and change. Will there be a print paper? I'm thoroughly convinced that yes, we'll always have a print version of the paper. But for people who've been long-term readers of the Tribune, the print version of the Tribune that you're getting today is not the print version of the Tribune that you got 25, 30 years ago.
Right.
It will continue to evolve and change and adapt to the marketplace to meet readers' demands, to meet how readers are consuming the news and the products that we produce. And so there'll be a print product. What will it look like in 25, 30 years? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, at KHOI, we really appreciate having a relationship with the Tribune and all of the papers in the area. It's still a really, really great asset to our community that we have local news. And we love having a friendship with you, Michael, and working together with
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. I enjoy it. Can I have 1 minute for a quick plug?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Go for it.
So in the past couple, 2-3 weeks, I've kind of started my own little social media campaign trying to tell people the importance of local news and the importance of being willing to pay for it.
Absolutely.
The number of people that I've responded to through social media or email that have said, why have a social media presence if I can't read your news for free?
Mm-hmm.
And the simple answer is we have bills to pay.
Yeah.
I'd like to pay my mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
My staff would like to put groceries on their table. It costs money to produce a quality product. It costs money to produce local news. So please support it.
Support local news.
Yep.
Yeah.
Michael Crum, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Michael Crum, the editor of the Ames Tribune, and I'd like you to have enough money to buy me coffee on Main Street.
I've got a company credit card, so it won't even come out of my pocket.
Thanks, Michael.
And that is Dennis Hart, cozying up to Mr. Michael Crum, editor of the Tribune. And I'm Ursula Rudenberg, hosting today. And we are the Wednesday team this morning, the usual Wednesday host. Susan Franson left for Sweden last Friday. But she did not forget us. She writes and says she's telling her Swedish friends about Scandinavian days and comparing Swedish and Norwegian foods. And she'll be in Europe for 6 weeks and maybe reporting on other things if she finds stories for us. But she sent us an interesting clip. She was eager to report this week because Stockholm was the home of Greta Thunberg, the teenager who started the worldwide climate strike that Ames participated in last week. And she actually found folks, amazingly, who know Greta's family. So she wanted to share this with you, a little inside in the news.
This is Local Talk reporter Susan Franson on location in Stockholm, visiting friends on the day after the worldwide climate strike on September 20th. When I arrived in Stockholm, I was fortunate to talk with our old friend Lars-Johan Norby, who was familiar with the family of Greta Thunberg. When did you hear about her here in Sweden?
Well, on the very first day of her school strike, and that is about a year and a half ago or something. And she's of a very well-known family because her mother is a very, very attractive and excellent opera singer. Malena Erlin is her name. And her father is an actor. And her grandfather was also an actor. So she's of a theater and opera family. And she's a bright young kid. And she's been quite exposed here at home from the outset.
I know they invited her into the Swedish parliament to speak. How did that happen?
Well, she was sitting every Friday afternoon for about a year. And it took a while before she was sort of generally appreciated by the public and the journalists. So it took a while before she was invited to the parliament. She was totally like a true activist working outside. But she was really rather gentle and did it as her personal demonstration. And it was on the Friday afternoons, and gradually the interest in her picked up. And within a year or so, she was well known.
In America, if somebody sat every Friday on the steps of the Capitol, security would probably just remove them.
No, no. We have security people, but they don't move young activists away.
Thank you, La Shohan. For a view from another generation, let's hear what your grandsons, Niels and Viking Norby, have to say, as well as their mother, Anna. Niels Norby, how do you feel?
I think that what Greta does is really great, especially since she started in Stockholm in Sweden. How we affect the climate is not as big as in the US. So how she grew, and now that she's in the US, I think she's come really far. And that's great, because then we actually can do a difference.
How did you first learn about her?
A year ago, there was news about this girl who didn't want to go to school because she wanted to take a stand against the climate change.
Have you been involved?
No, I haven't been active in any strike. But I still think it's great, and I would like to go to a strike at some point.
Thank you, Niels. His twin brother, Viking, what do you think?
I think that Greta is absolutely doing good things, lifting up the climate change to the world, politicians. But I think that not going to school for me and my friends is not the way we want to make our voice heard. Because right now it's been quite a few strikes in Stockholm at least. And I have not actually been at any one of them because I simply just want to have my classes and not risk missing any important facts.
Thank you, Viking. Their mother, Anna Norby, is here too. You have a little different perspective, not only as a parent, but I believe, how do you know anything about her family?
Yes, I am a friend of her mother, Malena, and a colleague. We've been working together and going to the same schools, the Music Academy and the Opera School together. We are colleagues, and I know that the family had very much trouble with their daughter, Greta, at early age, because she has some disabilities, and they had a lot of trouble getting her to function at all. And it was very hard for the family to get her to focus on something productive and something positive. And when finally she got caught up in rescuing the planet climate idea, she wanted to do the school strike, it was not very well received by her parents because they thought that she should go to school. And of course in Sweden it's mandatory to go to school. So when she started to do the strike, for first in her life she had a focus and she was positive and she was engaging and was active in something, but she didn't go to school. And the priority as a parent was that she should go to school. So I know they were very twisted as a family because, well, it was like mixed emotions. And now it has turned out to be something very positive for the family, for her too, of course. And I hope, and I can hear her speaking, it's that she's gotten her education from the roots and up instead of learning all the facts in school and then turning it to something more. So as a parent, I totally oppose going not to school, but Greta has done once in a million things with her actions, that she can do some difference.
Do you feel that focus on climate is an appropriate focus?
Yes, of course it is. And I think it's very positive that we have to engage the youth and the new generation to do something about, because we cannot waste our planet like we do.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Local Talk. That was Susan Franson coming to us from Stockholm, Sweden. Thank you, Susan. And we have been your hosts today in Susan's absence, Ursula Rudenberg and Dennis Hart. Thank you for listening in. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Please remember that you can also hear a recording of the show later today at our website, khoifm.org, and you'll find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember that KHOI is always streaming live at khoifm.org. Just click on the microphone.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come on down and join the Local Talk team. Stay tuned now for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m.
Remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Cirque May, Wednesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.